This is Jason Little, the world's greatest cold fusion developer, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Lockard. And today I am very happy to have Llewellyn Falco on all the way from Helsinki, Finland. So thanks for coming along, Llewellyn.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So Llewellyn, I was very fortunate in that a few months ago, I got to meet you at the Agile Alliance Technical Conference in Boston. However, for anyone that may not have been as fortunate as I to either run across you at a conference or know about you, can you just give a quick introduction of who you are and what you're passionate about?
Yeah, so I'm Llewellyn Falco. I'm an Agile technical coach. And that means that I spend a lot of time sitting with programmers and programming together, right? I don't really work on the management side. I don't work on the process side. I work on the code side. So a lot of times we do legacy code. Sometimes we do test-driven development. Sometimes we do DevOps. It really sort of depends on where the team is. And I do that for about a third of my time sort of across the globe. And then I spend about another third of my time speaking at conferences and attending conferences and just sort of learning. We also put on a couple of conferences. And so that also is really interesting to me. Like I enjoy speaking, but I also really enjoy like all the different new ideas that you get at conferences. And then I spend about a third of my time doing teaching in open space or open source. So I have a couple open source projects, notably Approval Test, which is a verification framework for unit testing. And I co-founded Teaching Kids Programming, which is free and open source courseware for 10-year-olds and up to teach them how to program in Java.
Right. And you and Woody have a pretty tight, Woody's will have a pretty tight connection in the creation of the original mod programming framework that then kind of rolled out into that practice that is pretty well known at this point.
Yeah, so about 2003, I was introduced to pair programming, which was just a really fortunate break in my life. Pairing is really just accelerates learning. And, you know, I think we'll talk a bunch about like investment and interest, but to get introduced to something that increases my learning very early in my career, like it couldn't have been a better gift for me. And from that, I created a style of pair programming called Strong Style, which is like regular pairing, except for the person at the keyboard isn't the person thinking. And then that, when I got introduced to Randori, started turning into a way of doing Randori with Strong Style that me and Woody used to do all across. And then that turned into mob programming, which is just yet another gift. It was surprising to see that something that we were doing solely for the purpose of learning is just that productive in production. And, you know, I think, again, that just goes to the power of learning, which I think is very often understated.
Right. And that is the topic of the podcast today is learning in general. And this kind of emerged from a meetup that we went to while we were up in Boston. And it was actually a sidebar conversation, and it might have just been me and you, or actually it could have been before we went to the meetup or after we went to the meetup, because I believe Arlo Bashley was also involved in the conversation. But
we were having drinks in the bar.
Yeah, that's why I can't remember it crystal clear right here. but we started a little, you know, 2-3 person conversation around the importance of learning and how humans learn and misconceptions. And just to give you and maybe some of the listeners context, the space that I work in professionally is a learning management system. So an LMS specifically geared towards clinical professionals. So the concepts and the importance of learning is something that not just interests me, but it's also critically important to my job. So, the good news is, because we were sitting in that bar and having that conversation, all of the things that I said that made you cringe, I don't have to say again. I had a rapid feedback loop. I say something, Llewellyn cringes, I realize I might be going down the wrong rabbit hole. So
there's a lot of misconceptions about learning, right? And a lot of how we teach and how we learn is sort of how we were taught. And so there's this unfortunate cycle of just we teach the way we were taught, and that cycle perpetuates, and we learn new ways on what works and what doesn't work, but they don't make it into our actual actions, right? And so you'll actually hear professors of learning give very long lectures about what they have learned. In fact, I remember listening to a podcast on the You Are Not So Smart podcast, which is a cognitive science podcast I really enjoy. And there was a university professor talking about her research into telling stories and how powerful it is to tell stories, how people remember things better when you tell stories, how you sound smarter when you tell stories. It was an hour podcast about how great stories are as a mechanism. And she didn't tell a single story that entire hour. And I'm like, I'm going out of my head, because I'm like, your very own research that you are talking about right now is telling you that the style that you're presenting in is not the style you should be doing. And yet that's the way that academics have talked. And so that's the patterns and the habits that we grow up with and that we internalize. And then we replay when we're put into those situations. And a lot of learning and a lot of teaching goes that way. It's, this is the way I was taught, and therefore it must be a good way. Or this is the way I learned, and look, I turned out okay. Therefore, this process must be okay. There's an actual bias for that called survivorship bias. But it's really prevalent. And habits control more of our actions than we'd really like to admit to.
So yeah, and there is that the Power of Habit book that came out in the last 5 or 10 years, and in there it really talks about how habits are stored in the part of your brain that is the most early formed part of your brain, and the triggers that get stored in, it's called the basal ganglia, and the triggers that get stored in that basal ganglia are so hard to overwrite once they've been stored there, because
so. I love that book, and I love those triggers, and I've been using it to hack my life over the last year. I read the book back in August of last year, and I've actually done two hacks based on that book, which have been amazing for me. One that I did way back last August, right? So I can talk about that like with credibility, as that habit has worked, and one that I did just last Thursday. So it's been exactly 1 week since I did this hack, and I don't know if it will last, right? Like, it's interesting talking about it on a podcast where podcast won't get released for, you know, a week or two. And so hopefully everything is still in place by then. But then when people actually listen to it, like, you know, hopefully the hack works, but so far it's been remarkably easy. And that's the thing that's been really amazing to me, is the book talks about habits in terms of making habits, which is fairly hard to do, but is a very doable thing, right? We all have habits. We didn't start with habits. They all come from somewhere. Removing habits, which it turns out is a almost impossibly hard thing to do. But something that looks very, very close to removing a habit, which is swapping a habit, mm-hmm. right? And so I'll tell you, like, my first habit swap, I'll do it in reverse order. I'll do the one I just started this week. So I've been thinking that it would be good to do some form of exercise and build some strength, maybe some upper body strength. And so I wanted to try to do push-ups. And I tried maybe about a month before the conference there, so about 2 months ago, I tried doing this thing. It was a 100 push-up challenge. And so they have like a schedule, and you do some push-ups on Monday and then Wednesday and then Friday, and then you rest the other days and you try again. And I tried that, and I did it for about 2 weeks, and then I just lost it, and it didn't come back, which is, I think, a lot of things that I experiment with and try to do new things. If you ever do like New Year's resolutions and stuff, you know, it's very rare that they outlast 2 weeks. So I want to revisit it and say, like, what can I do? And I noticed a really weird habit that I have, which is I really like playing video games in general. I'd say maybe games in general even. But in specific, I've been playing a lot of games on my phone and on my iPad. And and like a lot of them, right? Because they're so easy to play little 1 or 2 minute games. And what I noticed is that if I play one game, a lot of times I'll end up playing like 3 or 4 games,
mm-hmm.
right? And the reason is there's this point when I finish a game where I will just sort of be like, oh, the game is over. What do I play next? Right. And that trigger is very strong in me that like, I game is over. I ask, what is the next game I'm going to play?
Right.
And so I'm like, maybe I can hack that trigger. So I said, every time a game is over, right? Not before I play a game, which would just be annoying, but when the game is over, I'll do one push-up. Right. Which is not a lot. In the very beginning, I was wondering, like, maybe I should try more, but I'm actually really glad that I did not try more because it turned out that, like, I play a lot of games, and at the end of the first day, my arms are killing me. in fact, to the point that habits are so powerful because so much of what we do without thinking that, you know, if I had started with just, like, one push-up on my knees, I don't know what that's called, but, like, it's not a real push-up, but, like, a fake push-up. Half push-up maybe or something like that. I don't think it would matter as long as the habit continues, right? Because if I can do that for a week, then the next week I can easily do push-ups on hands. And, you know, like, again, time is on my side. Like, I'm old, right? So habit plus time, like, is going to equal a lot of anything. So it doesn't actually have to be – it doesn't have to be something amazing. It just needs to continue. And I'm shocked at how easy it's been to continue this habit and just complete, like, again, it's been about a week. Over the course of the last week, I've probably done something in the neighborhood of like 500 to 600 pushups. And it hasn't been that hard. And again, it just, unlike almost every other habit I try to form where it takes a lot of willpower and a lot of effort, this habit wants me to do something every time a game, like my brain wants to do something when a game finishes. It really strongly wants to do something. And so now it just has a different something that it's doing, which is perfectly fine for my brain. That's actually not the part it cares about. It cares about, I got to do something, game's over. I got to do something, game's over. And so if I can make it just a different thing, it was actually quite easy to swap. And sort of the swap occurred somewhere within the first 20 times I did it, which sadly was about the first 2 hours of the first day, right? Like, I mean, it's a lot of games. It's actually a lot of Clash Royale right now, which is a fantastic game. But yeah, I mean, it was really, really simple to do. And then the other one I did, and okay, so that one I've only had for a week, right? So, you know, next time you see me, like, check and keep me honest that this habit has persisted. But it feels actually very similar to the swap I did last year, which was I decided, and I wasn't even, it's weird, right? Because I was curious about the push-ups, but I wouldn't say I'm, like, passionate or excited about push-ups. I was like, hey, it would be good. If I was excited about push-ups, like, I wouldn't have gotten to 40 and not be able to do push-ups. But water was the same thing where I was like, well, it feels like I'm drinking a lot of soda. Maybe I should try to cut back, you know. I'm not sure what to cut back with. The one thing that everyone seems to universally agree with is water is not bad for you. Everyone seems to be on the same page for that. So I was like, well, let's see if I can swap to water, right? And I had just read the book at that time, so I was actually more interested in how easy is it to swap a habit than I was in water. So I started looking for the trigger again, right? Which is, you know, sort of the same thing I was looking at with the video game ending. And what I noticed is, so I sort of asked myself sort of every time I found myself drinking something like, hey, what just happened?
right? One of the interesting parts about learning in general is metacognition is super important and helpful. And one of the things that we usually don't think about, right, is we think about the learning, but we don't think about how we learn, right? We don't look at the situations that get us into the situation that we're now looking at. And so that was one of the things they talked about in the book. And so every time I'd end up with a drink in my hand, I just sort of replay, hey, what happened in the last minute that led me to this space? And one of them was like, I think what everyone would think, which I was in the fridge, I was thirsty, I opened the fridge, right? Sometimes that's not even entirely true. Sometimes I'll just open the fridge because I walk by the kitchen. But either way, I open the fridge. And then I grab a bottle and I start drinking, right? So I drink a lot of Pepsi Max that way. And so what I did is I replaced the bottle. Well, I didn't replace it because I have other people in my house who I did not want to inflict this upon. But I stocked the fridge with bottles of water, right? So there was always a bottle of water in the fridge. So now the exact same trigger, I'm opening the fridge because I'm thirsty, grab a bottle of water instead of a bottle of soda, and then get the same result of I'm no longer thirsty. So that worked out pretty good. But it turned out there was other things that would have looked like drinking water habit. So one of them was, if it's late at night and I'm tired, I will drink soda just, you know, for the caffeine. And that one was a little bit harder. And mainly the way that I've been reacting to it is just actively taking naps or going to sleep when I realize that, you know, hey, I want something because I want to stay awake, and just asking myself, do I really need to be awake right now? Like, what's the harm in actually just going to sleep? And most of the time, there is no harm, like something that I can do. And then the last one surprised me. I was literally like, I was sitting there drinking, and I was like, why am I doing this? And I'm like, oh, I was walking to the bathroom because I woke up in the morning and my mouth tasted bad. And so I went to brush my teeth. And as I was walking to the bathroom, I walked by a bottle of soda and I took a drink of soda, which changed the flavor in my mouth completely. Ironically, changed it so that I no longer wanted to brush my teeth because toothpaste and soda is like a gross combination. And that again was like another, once I was aware of the things that are going on, it was just the only thing you have to do is count to 10. And now you're actually brushing your teeth, and like the problem is solved. So all those things like came together, and again, I had the same experience that I'm having right now, which is, you know, within a very short time of day of a very short period of time, like a day or two, it just was no longer a problem. My habit had swapped to drinking water instead of drinking soda, and you know, here I am 8 months later, and all I've drunk in the last 8 months is water.
And this one I can attest to because I remember when I did first meet you, it was either before we went to the meetup or after we got back from the meetup, we were sitting in the hotel lobby. And I even asked you if you wanted a drink and you said, no, I'm on this water thing. You didn't explain it to any great detail there. And I thought, I remember I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, what does this guy know that I don't know? You know, for the first
nothing.
For the first hour or so, I'm like wrapping my head around the fact like there's all these brilliant people talking around me about all these really deep agile concepts and nerding out real hard. And like, what is Llewellyn up to that he's drinking water? And then after the first hour, I'm like, hey, this double IPA I've been drinking for an hour is delicious. I'll keep doing this and stop worrying about Waterboy over there.
Yes, it definitely makes me less interesting at a bar.
I think I just really let my I think I really just let my Philly come through water. So it's not water, it's water.
But I mean, these things are really powerful. And as a coach, learning to do this with teams is even more powerful, right? So your teams will have habits, and a lot of times we will refer to them as cultural norms. Which are just, I think, fancy words for habits that occur at work, where the triggers are at work. But if you can start to recognize them, right? And again, they can be kind of subtle, or you have to break them down. Like sometimes two different triggers can look like the same action because they're playing the same record, but they're actually being triggered for two completely different reasons. But if you can change those, your team doesn't have to be disciplined about wanting to do something. The pattern that is already in their brain will take over that for them. And this moves into an area of learning that is not talked about that much, but I think is critical, which is fluency, right? And fluency is things you can do without thinking about them. And the way you do that is repetition. And, you know, habits are going to get you to repetition faster than anything we got.
Right.
So it's just an excellent way of building fluency. And there's a lot of important things, but fluency is just one of those things of learning that I care about. But it's a big one.
So let me ask you this. Recently, I've had my teams at work have run into a stretch of unfortunate events. So I work in, like I said, it's a clinical learning management system, and it's got about 15 to 16 years of legacy code. This team has been working on trying to correct in the last 2 to 3 years. And obviously you're chipping away at an iceberg. When you talk about fluency or when you talk about the habits that are formed, whether they're conscious or subconscious, you typically tend to run into what those patterns and habits are at a time of crisis. And as I was alluding to, this team's had some issues that no one on this team actually instantiated, you know, however many years ago these bugs were written, but they've come to the surface now. And it's been a pretty critical stretch of time. And in there, it's interesting. I mean, just for me at my level and taking that mindful step back to look at how, you know, the problems get solved and the teams interact, you get to see those areas of high function. Folks that have been going through that learning cycle, that cognitive cycle of figuring out, you know, in the time, if this, then I'll do that. If this, then I'll do that. They go through that kata. But then you see the other areas of the organization where, you know, they just ostrich problems where they stick their head in the sand. And when a problem shows up, there's a high degree of dysfunction. Do you see the same where your habits really come through and they really show when you're in a high stress environment?
So there's so much to impact in that. So, I mean, absolutely. Like when you're in a high stress environment, your habits and your training are the things that you go back to. And I don't mean like training in terms of like intellectual training in this point. I mean, training in sort of what have you done over and over and over again to instill those systems into you. Right. And a lot of times we actually train badly, and there's a lot of different reasons for that. I was just listening to an Adventure Time the other day with Jake the dog, and he had this wonderful quote. It was like, sucking at something is the first step in being pretty good at something.
I really like that, actually. That's sad.
It's a wonderful quote. And the thing is, like, this is really true, right? And there are good and bad parts about that. But one of the unfortunate parts about that is it means that when you start out, you're usually not that good. And when you start out, a lot of times we start creating a habit. Hmm. And so there is an unfortunate part of you can learn something in such a way that, and usually in the way we learn stuff is in such a way that however we learned it is the most powerful way that we're going to do it. And of course, we're learning it as a complete noob. And so we're doing a lot of stupid things, which is when you talk to people who've like gotten to like fairly good expertise on whatever it tends to be, they'll talk a lot about like really slowing down on the thing that they're learning, right? And learning to do it really, really well, but really, really slow. And then speeding up the thing that they're doing. And in fact, I've just this last month, I have two stepkids, and we just started to teach them to type. And they're actually very young. This is a typing technique that I came up with a while back. And when the kids I had then were older, and so you know, new family. And so they're 8 and 9 and we're teaching typing to them. And on top of that, an interesting thing is with the invention of phones and iPads, you know, while the house has always been like technologically focused, a lot of the typing that they do is actually not on physical keyboards, right? Most of their experience is actually not on a computer as such as on a handheld device. And so normally the way that we do it, there's a typing tutor that I wrote up. It's in Java. You just sort of open it up and these sharks come at you with words and you type on them and they go away. And normally what we do is we put them on a split keyboard, which of course we do here too, because a split keyboard is going to sort of force your hands into effectively the right position, right? It doesn't force them, but it does sort of encourage. And of course, like reaching across the center is almost impossible on a split keyboard, right? So it's very, very obvious that the Y is for the right hand and the T is for the left hand. Whereas on a regular keyboard, that's a much blurrier situation. And then you make them type for 10 to 15 minutes a day. Right now I'm doing 10 minutes. And then, you know, the next day you do it again and you take some black nail polish and you put it over a key. And so now they're typing on a keyboard that has one blank key, which is not that hard. If you've been typing on a keyboard that has no blank keys, and then you do it again and the next day, and then you're on two keys, which isn't that hard if you're used to one key, and you know, then you're doing on 20 keys, which isn't that hard if you're used to 19 keys, and then all of a sudden you're on a blank keyboard, right? And this sort of takes advantage of subtle change over time, which is something humans actually have a hard time even noticing. And you can use that as a really good teaching tool. And so, but with the kids, like they're so new to just this whole concept of keyboarding that in the beginning I'm not even getting to remove the letters. I'm slowing down, and I actually went into the program because I wrote it myself and I said, you know, let's turn the speed down. Like let's start it with one shark before I starting with four, and let's turn the speed down to like, you know, 75% of where it was before, because I'm not really concerned about how fast they're typing right now. I want them to get used to their hands go in a certain place, right? And then in the very beginning, like with the 8-year-old, I wasn't even worried about their hands being in the right place. All I was focused on was the stuff that's on the right side of the keyboard, you're hitting with the right hand, and the stuff that's on the left side, you're hitting with the left hand, right? So the hands aren't, but then once they get that, then we're like, okay, now your hands are basically sitting on the home keys and moving. And then we're focusing on, okay, and they're moving directly up and down. So at least you're not moving side to side on the things. And then after all that, we can say, okay, now that you're doing all these things right, let's start removing the keys. Let's start speeding up the number of the speed of the words, right? But I want to instill those patterns because you're right. As soon as you get stressed, you're going to revert back to what is most hardwired in your body, right? And what I want to do is hardwire the right things. So when you're stressed, you'll go back to those, right? Because you're not being disciplined and stressed at the same time. That's not a thing. You know, it's the worst side of you that comes out when you're stressed, not the best side.
Right. And, you know, that it, a lot of times when you go to, you read in a book around agility or lean, or you go to a talk about agility or lean, there's usually either going to be a martial arts reference or a military reference. And I think one thing that is true about the military references is that the military trains very hard, very long, and very intently to simulate those high stress scenarios. But not exactly what you do in those high stress events, because there's so much there's so many dynamics that can be thrown in those environments that they're just trying to drill in what could you do, what should you do, you know, those types of things. And I think that you know, it somehow that translates directly to teaching kids to type. It creates an environment where you're taking away those keys one by one, and you're hardwiring in, okay, if thumb does this, you know, index does that, right?
Yeah, and in terms of fluency and patterns, that's something that the military teaches really, really well, right? I mean, there's, again, there's a lot more to learning than just fluency and patterns, but it is a big part of it. And there are a lot of things that, especially things that are skill-based, right? Like, they're going to be important. You were talking about your entire team and the way that they're dealing with this existing code base.
Correct.
And that, so this goes to, like, yes, what they do is why they've been doing stuff for 15 years, right? Like, most likely, if you jump back 4 years, the patterns that you would see are probably going to be the same as the patterns you're seeing right now. Do you guys pair your place of work?
I'm smiling. You can't see me right now because Llewellyn Falco's heart would grow a little bigger if you saw me. Every workstation has two sets of keyboards, two sets of mice.
Nice.
We have we do have a TV, a couple of rolling stand TVs that we mob around at times. So yeah, I mean, it's not even do we do pairing. Pairing is part of how we create software.
How long have you been doing pairing?
We started introducing it probably about 2 years ago. And then we really hit a stride about in the last 9 to 12 months.
And have you seen a lot of new things develop over the last 2 years compared to the previous 13?
Yeah, and the things that you see come in, there's different flavors, right? So one of the most, I'm going to say cool, but I guess it really depends on how you define that word. One of the coolest things that I saw emerge from it was pairing went from part of how we create software to how we interview candidates. And anybody that comes onto my program in any technical capacity does a pairing exercise as part of the interview. Because
I think that's invaluable.
There's more to it than just can they write the code. It's how do you behave in that scenario? How do you communicate? I think you either get full or partial credit for the idea of pairing is not about writing more code. It's about two brains writing the same piece of code. And there's a dance that happens there. There's a lot of social activity that happens when you have any number greater than one working on the same thing.
And one of the things that Arlo did in a little lightning talk, this is a few years back at an Agile convention, but has really been helpful for me, is he talked about the way brains like numbers, right? And basically his statement was like, if you don't know anything, if you have zero answers, your brain really wants an answer, right? So if you're like, I don't know why the sky is blue, your brain is really going to want an answer to that question. And if someone comes around and says, like, the sky is blue because, you know, there is blue particles that float in the sky, you're going to be like, okay, yeah, that's why the sky is blue, right? And then if your brain has one answer, it wants to stay at one. So if someone comes around and says, like, well, the sky is blue because we have particles floating in the air, and someone else comes and says, hey, no, it's because of the way the sun is refracting, your brain doesn't want two answers. It wants one. So it's going to try to figure out which one of these to stay with, right? And in the very beginning, it will stay with the one that it knows. But if you can keep causing, like, problems with that model, it will jump to the other model, right? But either way, it doesn't want both of those answers. It wants a single answer. So if you're at zero, it wants to go to one. If it's at one, it wants to stay at one. If it's at two, it wants to go to one. However, an interesting thing occurs at three, right? Which is at three, you start looking for more answers, right? At the point that you've gotten to three, like, three ideas that are comfortably held, now you just want more. And we'll see the same sort of thing in languages, right? Where it's like people, like, have never learned to program, like, they jump on their first language, and once they get to one language, they want to stay with one language. Like, it will vary, right? It might even vary throughout their lifetime, but they'll have the one language that they basically know, right? And then if you can get to two, like, that will be your time where you switch, where it's like, hey, I used to do a lot of programming in C, and now I do a lot of programming in Java, and I don't do anything anymore with C. Or I used to do a lot with C, and now I do a lot in JavaScript, but I don't do anything more with Java. But it's like your brain wants to move, right? Because two wants to go to one. But then you'll get people who go for,
who become polyglot, right? Where they get to like three languages that they're holding. And those people very quickly get to like 20 languages, right? Where it's once you make it past that curve, it's going to go up. And I've seen the same sort of thing occur in pairing in mobs, right? Where it's in the beginning, there's just the way you do it. If I'm working by myself and I have a way of solving it something, that's the way I'm going to do it, right? And I was working with someone just the other day. I have like a Slack channel that I'm part of, and we do like a Wednesday meet. And so we were taking a look at some legacy code and just sort of tearing it apart for practice. And his comment is like, we work by ourselves, right? And I've been working on this project by myself for 6 years. And when you're working alone, it's really hard to learn anything new, right? And that's just the case. Like by yourself, it's really hard to learn anything new. As soon as you bring in a second person, there's a good chance that you will try something new. And then figure out which the best one is, right? Like, so you can move, right? And if you move that to a mob, you get this very interesting thing that occurs where the first person does the way that the group knows. And then the second person like introduces the new idea. And then that usually will spark and you'll get a third new idea and a fourth new idea, a fifth new idea. And again, you'll usually try to like come to something that like culture and norms, because we still want patterns and we still want habits, but you're going to have this huge explosion of knowledge, right? And again, like compared to by yourself where you get zero, pairing is just huge, right? Because, you know, compared to zero, everything is huge. Right. But there's even more that can occur.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, please.
No, well, the other thing that kind of emerged when my team really started taking to the pairing was it forced mindfulness, right? So if you're working in isolation on anything, it doesn't even matter if it's technical or not, you have your way of doing that. But as soon as, to your point, you add a second or a third person into the conversation, you start talking about what you're doing either during or before you start doing the thing. And what my team started, you know, again, 17 years of legacy code, there's probably a whole bunch of standards employed in that code, meaning there's not really any standards. And then you see an intentful, mindful change to, okay, guys, we need to start having some domain dictionary. We need to start having some domain model that actually makes sense, and we're going to have to start employing standards. And it's only because the conversation was embraced in the form of mobbing and pairing that problem was acknowledged and starting to be addressed. I mean, it's going to be a multi-endeavor, but.
No. And that's a huge progress, right? And again, these changes and the fact that things have been like going good over the last 2 years is a really good sign. I want to talk a little bit about the math of that. Actually, let's talk about that now, because one of the things that's really interesting about programming and maybe things in general is we talk a lot about ROI, right? Like the return on investment. And I think that's a useful conversation. I definitely think it's a necessary conversation, but I think that we are just really shite at calculating it. And let me give you like just a little bit of example, because things get complicated and it actually gets to fairly complicated math that, you know, not complicated like, you know, like derivatives or stuff, but complicated like integrals. And so let's say that you have two people, right? And so person one, right, they come in, they do their work, they're all about doing the work, right? So they come in, they work 8 hours a day. At the end of the day, they'd run 8 hours worth of work. And then person two comes in, they spend the first hour of a day, they don't do any work, but they learn, and then they'd spend the next 7 hours doing work. So they only get to be productive for 7 hours a day, and the other person gets to be productive for a full 8 hours a day. But that hour of learning that they spend increases their productivity by 1%. 1% is like not a lot. It's what I could do in 8 hours today, I can do in 7 hours and 56 minutes tomorrow. So like maybe a keyboard shortcut if I could learn a keyboard shortcut in a single hour, that would give me 1% return the next day. And so the first question is, at the end of a year, who has produced more? Is it the person who is diligently working 8 hours a day, or is it the person who's only working 7 hours a day, but learning 1% each day? And do you have like a gut feel on who produces more?
My leaning is towards person B because they're actually accelerating their optimization and their learning, but feel free to tell me.
No, that's absolutely right. After a year, the person who's accelerating is doing good. So now let's start to look on where that return on investment breaks down. Let's say I have a slower learner. They still only gain 1% a day, but it takes them 2 hours instead. So they're only working 6 hours a day. Now who's doing better?
Okay, so using economies of scale, I'm still thinking person... Oh, you're going to tell me I'm wrong here. I'm going with person two still. Person three.
No. Yeah, person two is still ahead.
All right. Cool. I'm doing good. I'm passing the Lou.
What if I have like an extra slow person? Instead of 2 hours a day, they take 4 hours a day, right? So 4 hours a day they spend learning. They still only get a 1% gain on that, but then they spend 4 hours doing actual work. Now who's winning?
It's still going to be person two.
Still person two. Good. Okay. Well, what about 5 hours? They spend 5 hours for that 1% and only 3 hours of actual work. Now who's winning?
Honestly, I'm changing all of my answers. It's whoever writes the least amount of bugs that's actually contributing the most value. Because all we're doing now is we're just looking at throughput, and throughput does not equal value. But sure, I'm going to go with person two.
What if they spend 6 hours? What if they spend 6 hours a day and only 2 hours a day learning?
You mean only 2 hours a day productive or 2 hours?
Oh, sorry. Only 2 hours a day productive, 6 hours to get that 1% advantage.
We'll go with person two again, my friend.
Yeah. So that's actually where the breakdown stops, right? Like it's actually about if they spend 2.5 hours of work, they'll slightly beat, but basically tie the person who does 8 hours.
Really?
Yeah. And that's year one. It turns out if you take that experiment to 2 years, they'll still beat them. But in 1 year, which I think is like a reasonable amount of time to expect you to still be at a job. At 2.5 hours a day of real work and in the entire rest of the time just spent learning, you will still cream the other person even at just a 1% gain. And this goes to that part of like our gut reaction of where ROI is. Isn't there. If you came in and you saw somebody who was just looked like they were, you know, doing practice stuff and not doing real work for 5 hours a day and only working 3 hours a day, you would not look at them and say, that's good return on investment. Right. And yet, that's still a good return on investment. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, most of us have really bad retirement funds is because we didn't realize that. You know, just $100 a month, you know, if we had started when we're 20, would be, you know, $1 million or $2 million, you know, when we retire. Interest is a complicated thing.
So the one thing I've never thought about learning in the financial metaphor that you gave there. And the one thing that was jumping off in my brain as you were talking was so I work in some form of management, right? I'm not technically on teams as much as I was in the past, but we are in large enterprises. We are very keen to capitalize projects. Capitalize assets, right? And what that means is basically there's two buckets of funding. There's CapEx, yep. There's OpEx or operationalized. For anyone that's not into finance, which I'm not a person that's into finance, but I'm begrudgingly into it now. All that means is anything OpEx, you pay that down in the year that it's incurred. So if your fiscal year is your calendar year, you have to pay all your operational expenses that year. Anything that's capitalized is something that you pay off over a given period of time. It's basically the same thing as credit card debt, a mortgage. So you're taking
Except for in this particular case,
the way that you say pay it off isn't the actual paying of it. It's how it comes for accounting and taxes and quarterly reports.
Correct.
Right. The money actually still leaves at the same rate. It's just you don't have to account for it the same way.
But we look at software and we look at assets in that format where things have derivative value in the future, and it's not all realized at once. But when we look at things like learning, we look at people as, you know, we're always OPEX. Learning is always operational. So there's a direct cost to learning now and we'll get no value from it in the future, which is just obviously wrong. And you just played it out in that simulation of the six different folks that are spending different amounts of time learning versus working.
Yeah. So I can't even like, we don't have enough time for the rant that would occur if we talked about how much damage is done based on accounting methods to software development. But yes, unfortunately, how you account that ends up making a lot of decisions that are just really unfortunate, because the simple fact is software is hard enough to figure out what to do right, how much effort to spend on which parts and what to do. Like, it's hard enough to do that, much less starting at the beginning of a year, which is when we make our targets for how much we want to capitalize versus expense, and then, you know, trying to match that number, right? Like, it forces people to do a lot of things that are for the wrong reasons. And then there's also this really weird part of like, somehow how you classify things is a little bit like word magic, right? So you can look at refactoring as like, oh, this is just part of maintenance. Or you can look at refactoring as we are investing in making our code better for the future, in which case it's an investment. And in a very realistic sense, it's the same thing, right? Because we play mainly in the intellectual world where you don't have real stuff, and so you can wordsmith a lot of accounting. This is an unfortunate part of how things go. It's also a really unfortunate part. Like when you said, you know, when you talk about we have 15 years of code, what you're talking about and that thing that shows up in the tone of your voice is compound interest of debt, right? It's things that should be easy are actually quite hard because, you know, we're looking at 1% worse over 13 years, which turns out to be really quite a lot. You know, and it makes it so that things that should be trivial in other systems might be critically hard. And an excellent example of this was the year 2000 bug, right? I mean, changing a date from 2 digits to 4 digits, I can do in about 30 seconds on a new project. And it was, you know, billions of dollars of work throughout our industry. A lot of systems actually got rewritten around that time because the cost of fixing that bug was so substantial that it would justify rewriting the project.
So I think we both are friendly with David Bernstein.
Yeah.
In his talks, he gives a different metaphor. Again, stepping out of the tech and just into something anybody can grasp. And he talks about the Space Needle in Seattle and the cost it took to actually build the Space Needle when it was built back in the 60s or 70s. Versus what it costs to repaint it now, it actually costs more to repaint the Space Needle than it did to originally build it. So,
oh, that's crazy.
Yeah. So, Llewellyn, I want to thank you. Unfortunately, we burned through an hour here.
Oh wow!
And we probably could have gone even longer. So your insight in learning is much broader than what we touched here.
Oh god, yes.
Yeah,
we spent a lot of time talking about the mechanic parts of learning, but we haven't talked about how to introduce new ideas or how to generate new ideas, and both of which are critically important.
Or how people actually learn, right? And that was part of the conversation that we had up in Boston. So hopefully we can pick this up in the future for a part two and dive into those topics. But until then, if anyone wants to get in contact with you or learn more about you or your projects, how would they track you down, sir?
Well, there's three good ways. First is I'm very open to connecting on LinkedIn. I find that to be a really good thing because you can message directly and basically everybody's on it. So that's a great way if you want to send me messages and stuff or to connect. LinkedIn is a really good way. Twitter is a great way to following like whatever random thoughts I'm excited about at the moment. I don't tweet that much, but I tweet a decent, a few times a week. And so if you're on Twitter, you can follow me there. I have a blog at llewellynfalco.blogspot. Generally, like my name is remarkably Googleable. I didn't realize the value of an internet unique name when my parents gave it to me. I don't think they did either, but it turned out to be a very nice gift. And then I have a lot of YouTube videos as well. So if you go to my YouTube channel, somewhere in the neighborhood, 30, 40 videos there. If you want to like spend a decent amount of time looking into things that interest me, you can go and check out the YouTubes. My name is LLEWELLYN. If you get that far and an F, you'll usually find me.
I'll put all of your all of those links into the show notes. So if you're listening to this while driving, don't go scrambling for a pen. We'll have it. Yeah. And we'll also get a link into mobprogramming.com and some of the other projects that you have going, because I think there's a lot of value and a lot of good in there. So I'm Ryan Lockard. You can track me down at either on the Agile Uprising Coalition, since I started it, at Ryan was available, at AgilePHL on Twitter. So thanks again, Llewellyn.
Nice. Oh, wait. Can I close with one thing that I've really been interested in lately?
Yeah, please.
So one of the things I've noticed is I learn a lot at conferences. Like if you go to someone at a conference and you say, what is your opinion about Docker? Some people love Docker. Some people don't like Docker. Some people haven't tried Docker. But one of the things you don't get is what's Docker? And so what I've noticed is a lot of people who are probably listening to this podcast have probably gone to a conference, right? Because there tends to be that correlation. If you haven't, my first thing is go to a conference. Like it doesn't matter which conference, go anywhere, talk to people outside of your world. The thing I think about a lot is it doesn't matter like where I go in the world, every place has good food, but no place has food that's so good that I want to give up the food from the rest of the world and only eat that food, right? So like, it doesn't matter how good stuff is being created where you are, the rest of the world has better stuff. And so go to a conference, start talking to people, start seeing what's out there. But like I said, most of the people listening to this probably have gone to a conference. And what I want to encourage them to do is go to their bosses and lobby and plead for your coworkers to go to at least one conference a year. You will find that people who you might be fighting with at work, if you can get them to a conference, they'll come back with ideas, new ideas that excite them, that will also excite you, that now you can encourage and work with. And a really great way to bring stuff into your team is to get the people who are stuck in your team out to the other conferences so that you're not convincing them of new ideas, but the hundreds and thousands of people at the conference are giving them new ideas and new stuff. I think our industry as a whole will just learn so much more if the average person who's doing programming and tech is going to a conference and getting new ideas. So that's what I want to leave with. I think that's really important
that.
For us.
I love that, and I echo everything you just said. So that is great. And coming from somebody that does have control on that that budget that we can.
Yes.
I try to make sure that we carve money out so that people can go. They can get that experience. They can start building that network, and they can come back with that fresh perspective. And speaking firsthand, there is high value, high return, an ROI conversation. So we'll end it there. Hopefully we told the story, like you talked about the woman that was talking about the power of storytelling. Hopefully there was a story in this episode and people took some good things away. We are the Agile Uprising. You can follow up the Agile Uprising on Twitter at Agile Uprising. Or you can go to agileuprising.com and find connections to all the different outlets, resources, and content that we have available. So, one last time, thanks a lot, Llewellyn.
Great to be here.